You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, welcome to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Neil and Julia Whiteside for the past 2 hours. But now, at midday, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly show discussing the latest cinema releases that want to take you out for an evening. Which new film should be granted a mere peck on the cheek and which should be indulged with a full-on snog? My name is Toby Miller and joining me in the studio today are Jenny Colley.
Hello.
Emma Marchant.
Hi there.
Sarah McIntosh.
Hello.
And Owen Baker.
Hello.
Today's show features a string of men toiling against the odds to build themselves a better world, sometimes quite literally, other times by defying the accepted conventions of love. Matthew McConaughey turns in yet another committed and compelling performance as the macho rodeo rider who is diagnosed with HIV in Dallas Buyers Club. An ingenious blend of blatant advertising and masterly animation, the Lego movie, pits a lowly Lego construction worker against the diabolical plans of Will Ferrell's evil president business. Victorian values are put to the test in The Invisible Woman, with Ralph Fiennes as the lovelorn Charles Dickens and Felicity Jones as the conflicted object of his affection. And Spike Jones, last seen on the small, sad island of Where the Wild Things Are, is in an equally contemplative mood with her, a science fiction romance between Joaquin Phoenix and his phone operating system. Plus, we talked to Professor David Ruseman about the current short film season at the Arts Picture House, designed to throw light on how the cinema has observed, reported on, and helped perpetrate the world of the conspiracy theory. That's all to come, but we start the show with a diagnosis.
Mr. Woodruff, you've tested positive for HIV. Have you ever used intravenous drugs? Have you ever engaged in homosexual conduct?
Homo, did you say homo? You made a mistake, because that ain't me.
Mr. Woodruff, we estimate you have 30 days left.
Newsflash, y'all. Ain't nothing out there can kill Ron Woodruff in 30 days.
Where are you going?
They got good meds out of Mexico that's better than what you can get here in the States.
This is protein, totally non-toxic.
And you can't buy this in the USA?
Not approved.
You could be making a fortune off of this.
You look great.
Actually, I look amazing.
Anything to declare? Nada.
They're importing illegal drugs for sale. It's a very serious offense.
They're not illegal. They're merely unapproved.
I've been looking for you, Lone Star.
Listen, Tinkerbell, unless you got more cash or new clients, I'm busy.
You don't deserve our money.
Cut you in. 5%.
25. Take it or leave it.
Welcome to the Dallas Buyers Club.
Even now, 33 years since the disease was first identified, Hollywood still keeps a relatively Ronald Reagan-like silence about HIV and AIDS. Even new release Dallas Buyers Club, despite its considerable awards buzz, took well over a decade to find funding and was eventually shot with minimal budget and time by director Jean-Marc Vallée. Set in 1985, Dallas Buyers Club stars Matthew McConaughey as Ron Woodruff, a rootin'-tootin' rodeo rider who approaches life with a determined alpha male swagger. But this swagger stumbles when he's diagnosed with HIV, caught through an unguarded moment with a one-night stand. Given a month to live, Woodruff throws away the hospital's prescribed medicine, which only makes him sicker, and instead heads over to the border to Mexico, where legal but unapproved HIV medicine is available. Soon he finds himself teaming up with Jared Leto's transgender patient, Rayanne, in a business to surreptitiously supply vital over-the-border, under-the-counter medicine to the many hundreds struggling with a still mysterious disease. Owen, to begin with you, and I know we've all seen this in the room, Dallas Buyers Club has won plaudits from every quarter for the performances of Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto. But is there anything more to this film than grandstanding, impressive acting?
A great deal, I think. I was actually a bit... went to this film with a bit of trepidation because of, in a way, that reputation. McConaughey's been fantastic of late. I mean, Mud is a wonderful performance, but and so you have kind of come to expect that from him, and there's a lot of talk about his performance and Jared Leto's in this film. So I was a little bit anxious. I'm getting, it sounds really kind of almost selfish, but slightly tired, if you like, of these films which are based around one astonishing grandstanding performance, and they're great, but they seem to be a lot of them recently. This film completely won me over, and almost not because of his performance. I actually think the performances of everyone in it are pretty fantastic. It totally won me over with its story, really, which is, I mean, it's quite simple in a way, and it's not to say there's nothing wrong with this film, but I really loved particularly the fact that no one in this film is perfect. In spite of McConaughey's, you know, it's a very impressive sort of thing that he does, and it's sort of altruistic, but it's always undercut with a slight sort of self-centeredness. There's one scene where it isn't, but there's a real sort of subtlety to the characters in this film, which I really like. Nothing's simple, nothing's kind of, there's very little of the sort of easy way out. And I really enjoyed it, and I think it's not just his performance that's great about it. I think the whole film is very well weighted and beautifully positioned, and I think it's great.
Sarah, did you think it should have played politics a little bit more and not been quite such a straightforward drama?
No, I mean, I think it got the message across. I mean, you know, any political message across. But, I mean, for me, it was a story about this man, and... I'm a huge fan of Jean-Marc Vallée. I've seen all of his French films, going back right to the beginning with *List Noire*. So I'm probably not the best person to be critical about it, because I can't fault him really. I think it's about that character's journey, and that it's. You know, it's sweet without being overly cloying. The character, there's a good, Owen said, there's a good balance in that he's not some, you know, there's an element of the crusading hero, but, you know, that's weighted with, you know, the less nice things about his character. And while the politics side is important, I mean, I think I still learnt a lot about, you know, the history of the social history of how HIV was dealt with back in that time from this film. So I think it was fine.
Sorry about the slightly distant question. There was some bleed through from Studio B, so my headphones suddenly filled with music, and I had to find the fader. Emma, does this play a little bit too? I'm playing devil's advocate here, but this film sort of plays a little bit, perhaps too simplistically, which is the reason I brought up the politics with Sarah. A little bit too you can prepare all you like, but if your mouth just screws up. It's a little bit too easy with its villains. It has this sort of pencil-necked executive who works for the FDA, and it's sort of, I found all of that a little bit too moustache-twirling, and especially in a Oscar season of films like Llewyn Davis and Wolf of Wall Street that don't really have villains, and they're a little bit subtler than I found this film was.
I don't know if I'd say that. I mean, I think actually you said sort of grandstanding performance, and actually... I don't think that McConaughey's performance in this is particularly grandstanding. It was a much subtler, quieter film than I was expecting. I think I was expecting some kind of barnstorming, and it isn't like that at all. And I find, yes, McConaughey and Leto are both, McConaughey in particular feels very authentic. I don't think it's a massive step out of his wheelhouse in many ways for him, because he obviously is from Texas and he is playing a bit of a good old boy, but it works well. But the villains, no, I wouldn't say it was, so, I mean, yeah, the FDA are obviously meant to be the bad guys in this, but you just kind of sense that they're doing their job. And as Owen said, you know, Ron Woodruff, and if you read about the real Ron Woodruff as well, there's a lot of kind of grey areas about how they have dramatised his life. It's probably not exactly as he was or whatever, but, you know, he doesn't come across as very altruistic, as Owen said. He seems to be pretty smarmy and in it for his own end, although you're not really sure what that is. I think the one person that I was disappointed in, if you want, you know, if you are going to go into supporting cast, I did feel I could have done a bit more with Jennifer Garner's character. I felt, I don't know, I she's probably the only sort of major female role in it, and I just felt she was a tiny bit wasted. But it is so beautifully done, though, and I think it is, it's an amazing study as well of just a really rough, it's quite a rough part of society as well, you know, the beginning, the rodeo scenes, the people, you know, his friends at the beginning, and it's not a nice part of society, if you will. And I think in general that's really well dealt with. It's, you know, it's a real underbelly of Texan society in the 80s, and I think that's done very delicately and very sensitively.
Jenny, I know you saw this a couple of weeks ago to preview, so I didn't want to bring you in straight away, but did you find that it threw light on an area that, of very recent history, that doesn't have very much documentation, that hasn't been discussed much in mainstream, and in the end this is a mainstream film, hasn't been discussed much in mainstream entertainment?
I suppose it hasn't directly been discussed much in movies. I think, you know, there are some really seminal films out there, like Philadelphia. I remember seeing when I was probably about 12, and it remains to this day one of my favourite films that I find difficult to rewatch. So I think, you know, from my own experience, I have seen other movies that have addressed this issue in one way or another, and it is something that I'm aware of as part of society, so I'm perhaps not best positioned to answer your question. I did think it was, as everyone else has said, it was a very delicate performance, and it was a very interesting take on the era. I didn't come out of it thinking, wow, I had no idea about all of that, the way that I did perhaps with 12 Years a Slave. You know, I think I was much more blown away by learning about slavery than I was learning about the struggle of HIV and AIDS in Dallas in the 80s, because that's a fairly specific era of history that I...
But did the film... I'm intrigued, and I'll bring Owen back here, but... Because this is such a specific moment, that I feel that sometimes Ron Woodruff's story isn't as interesting as other stories that we could have been told. In the end, it's not nearly as transgressive a narrative as you think it's going to be, and we don't. Could it have done with leaving one our central character? We only get one scene with Rihanna, and when he goes to visit his father to collect some to cash in his life insurance, basically. Yeah. And in the end, it still feels very much like it's playing it a little bit safe.
Yeah, of course that's true. You could, the filmmaker could absolutely have broadened his canvas, like broadened what he wanted to tell. But I don't think it's every filmmaker who makes a film about a specific piece of history's job to tell us everything about it. I think this does enough of making you think, blimey, that's a really interesting sort of, or not really interesting, but a sort of vaguely interesting period of history, particularly American history, particularly that part of America at that time with that subject. I don't think it necessarily has to tell you, you know, everything about that. I think at its heart, this film, rather than oddly a film about HIV or even about Ron Woodruff, is a love story between Jared Leto's character and McConaughey's character, and to a lesser extent Jennifer Garner's character, but I think it's about that the kind of how that it's the blossoming of that relationship which really draws you in. And you know, there's some terribly touching moments, and I think those moments in that relationship are the moments which change Woodruff in a way much more than his HIV diagnosis does. I think they're the moments where you go, oh, that's something that wouldn't have happened if he hadn't had this friendship in his life, and hadn't, you know, obviously he wouldn't have that friendship if he hadn't been diagnosed. But I think at its heart, it's a much more simple story than it's not really about the politics of it, really. And like you say, I think there is a problem. The FDA character is a bit simplistic, and I think actually the male doctor is also a bit, I mean, he gets progressively less and less likable throughout the film, and you kind of think, yeah, but he is a doctor and he is looking after HIV patients. I don't know if he'd be quite that cold about it.
I think there's a problem that, and it's also the problem with Jennifer Garner's character is this sort of perfunctionary love interest, which I noticed they keep highlighting in the trailers and in the TV spots as you've seen, come and see this film, but don't worry, Matthew McConaughey's playing a straight character. Yeah. There's a romantic angle in it.
Yeah.
I think the composite characters, which is Jennifer Garner and the Doctor, there were characters like that in Ron Woodruff's life, but this is a composite of many. I see the need for that, obviously, but they all tend towards a little bit of the simplistic, and I think that harms the film in a little way.
Can I just say that I think it tells, you know, it wasn't a crusading message movie particularly. It tells a story. Obviously, whoever it was who did, took 10 years to get there, they were interested in this story, and I think it tells a story, and a little bit like, it's not really like this at all, but like Philomena, it doesn't sentimentalise it, and it really could have done. There were moments I thought it could have gone really over the top, and I don't think it does. And I think the beauty, as Owen said, and I think Sarah said, the beauty is really in the small, in some of the really small moments that you just see the odd thing and you think, oh, that's, yeah, I don't know, it did touch me, but I think it touched me without being enormous about it and throwing it all in your face, which is a good thing.
Okay, we'll end it there. The Dallas Buyers Club opened last week and is screening at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a certificate 15. Even by the usual cynical standards of the towering number of animated films that get released each year, the Lego Movie seems particularly brazen, a toy starring in a film designed to sell more toys. But, as written and directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the Lego Movie does everything in its power to make the audiences forget it was probably a shareholder meeting that gave it life. Rather, the film focuses on a childhood joy of Lego, being able to build and then destroy just about anything. Chris Pratt voices Emmett, a standard Lego City construction worker who delights in the knowledge that every day will be exactly the same. Watched over by the seemingly benevolent eye of Will Ferrell's President Business, Lego City continues to expand. The old and ever-adaptable pieces make way for a new and modern conformity. But when Emmett stumbles across the nefarious activities of the mysterious Wild Style, a hooded computer hacker figure, voiced by Elizabeth Banks, his carefully constructed world falls apart.
What is happening?
You're the special. And the prophecy states that you're the most important person in the universe. That's you, right?
Yes. That's me.
Relax, everybody. I'm here.
Batman? Awesome!
Who are you here to see?
I'm here to see your butt.
Oh, my gosh.
Pow. Wham. First try.
My fellow master builders.
Hello!
Lord Business plans to end the world as we know it. There is yet one hope. The special has arisen.
I know what you're thinking. He is the least qualified person to lead us. And you are right.
We are entering your mind.
What?
I don't think he's ever had an original thought.
That's not true. Introducing the double-decker couch. So everyone could watch TV together and be buddies.
That is literally the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Let me handle this. That idea is just the worst.
Emma, critics the world over seem to agree that whilst the Lego Movie shouldn't work, and there wasn't that much excitement when it was in pre-production and production, oh no, it's a, you know, this is just marketing, it does somehow, and it works very well by most accounts. Did it work as a film, or is it merely just a great big shiny expensive advert?
No, not at all. It definitely worked as a film. In fact, I wasn't even excited having seen the trailer. I think I was more excited when you pointed out to me the guys behind it had done 21 Jump Street, which I do think is a genius piece of comedy hilarity from the last year. It just is a flat out funny film, which to me is, you know, the best thing you can ask about when you're doing for a family film. Every member of your family will get something out of this, and if they don't, then they either don't have a sense of humour or maybe they're dead. That's what I'm going to say, because if you're breathing, I think you will find something to enjoy in this film. The animation is really fresh. I mean, yes, it's, you know, what the way they can animate the Lego to me was, it was quite spectacular. The gleaming on the Lego piece, where they can animate the Lego to look like real Lego, you could almost think they could have built it. I may have asked that question of my husband, but that's because I'm very, very stupid.
I thought the same thing. I had to check after I saw the film. No, this isn't stop motion.
Some of it is stop motion.
They did build the whole set apparently out of 50 million Legos first, apparently, and then animate it. The animation is to be marvelled at.
It is.
If you'd started production on the Lego Movie and it was being funded by the Lego people, you'd spend the first few months of pre-production playing. Surely, this is all research. This is necessary to get the emotional impact of what we're heading for.
You would hope so. No, it is. It's sharp. The script is funny. It doesn't outstay its welcome. The voice work from Chris Pratt to Elizabeth Banks to Will Arnett to Will Ferrell to Morgan Freeman to Liam Neeson is, to a man, brilliant. I thought. That's so, yes.
Jenny, it plays with conventions, this film. I think that's one reason why critics have liked it so much. It raises the typical Joseph Campbell sort of man on a quest sort of plot that Hollywood loves so much and animated films can't get enough of, I must follow religiously. But then it abandons it or it plays around with it. Did it? Was that one of the many things that, you liked about it?
I like the spaceship in it. There was so much to like. I think the, much as Emma's saying, the surprise of just really enjoying it, because I think I mentioned beforehand that I didn't want to see this film because the stand for it toppled over on me when I was at the cinema some months ago, and I have this like issue with the movie as a result of this lingering resentment of my near-death experience. And so when you said go see this film, I was like, but I don't want to. And I was more than pleasantly surprised. I thought it was just a very funny, very interesting film. I'm not sure necessarily it would be suitable for the whole family, because I think very young kids might be confused by it, like 4 or 5 year old kids might be confused by it.
But you see, I mean, we take our kids to go and see a lot. So my youngest is 3, and the good thing about it is, even if they're not getting the story, visually it is sparkly and shiny and colourful enough for very young kids to be drawn into it. I mean, very, well, you know, 3, whatever, that's your call. It's a P, is it a U, I think?
I think it's a U.
So, and you know, and the jokes are not, there are jokes in there for adults, but they're not, you know, they're in no way inappropriate if anyone wanted to, you know, they're just sort of meta, so you get them as an adult. Like, you know,
sort of Pixar style of there is something for everybody,
but not inappropriate. And of course they've got that opportunity to throw every single minifigure they ever want to, so you've got all these characters coming in from all these different films. I think there was just a general squeak of excitement from our row when Milhouse from The Simpsons popped up, probably from all of us for a second, and it can get away with it because it's Lego, I suppose.
Well, do you think that might be part of the that might raise an issue though, in that people have compared this to the best of Pixar, and I've read some reviewers that says it's almost better than the second and third Toy Story films. But I found, whilst I enjoyed this film a great deal, I found it eventually just wore me down. I was sitting too close because I was quite late, so that's part of the reason why. But it was so relentless, and it never paused, and it didn't have, I don't feel it has, and it wasn't aiming for this, to be fair, but it has none of the I don't think it will have the longevity of Pixar. It didn't feel like something I need to return to very often, or it just felt a bit cold and sterile and clever rather than emotionally clever.
I wouldn't say it had a lot of heart. I mean, you know, you mentioned Toy Story 2 and 3. The thing, you know, Toy Story 3 in particular is just really a film that is all about heart, but I also think that...
We can't discuss the last act because the film came out yesterday and there's big spoilers, but I think it aims to have a lot of heart. It obviously goes the direction to bring that in, but I don't think any of that really works. And I think part of that is the fact you don't... It doesn't write any characters. It's got its leads, Wildstyle and Emmett, and then everybody else, because they're licensed figures. Again, no spoilers, but everybody knows Batman is in this and he has quite a large role. It doesn't have that Toy Story feel of I like this character. It's just familiar faces, and that sort of started to begin to annoy me. As delightful as it was, I thought it was a cheap way of keeping your narrative going.
I mean, just because they're licensed characters doesn't mean that they necessarily fulfill. I mean, they've got Dumbledore in it, and the whole scene of Dumbledore is everybody else mispronouncing his name.
No. They keep confusing him with Gandalf.
Yeah. Dumbledore, and he has a funny squeaky voice as well, which is
exactly
obviously amusing.
And it's nothing like squeaky voice. The Harry Potter. It's just him. My name is Dumbledore. Yeah. Over and over again, and it's really funny. There's a lot of moments in it that don't fulfill your expectations and are funnier as a result.
I think this whole thing about trying to compare, I mean, I don't know, we all sort of say, and I read a lot of reviews as well, it's like, oh, when was the last time Pixar made you gasp like this, disgenuates you gasp, whatever. There is a huge debt to be paid to Pixar, because I think, and I've said this in this very studio before, they raised the bar of animated films, without a doubt. But, you know, you don't have to kind of balance everything back to Toy Story or to Up, for example, which Up, as much as, you know, critics absolutely loved it and grown-ups loved it and I can't watch it again, my kids weren't really that enthralled by they weren't nearly as enthralled by Up as they would be by this. They would probably rewatch this, just as they enjoy watching Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Now, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, which has no story whatsoever, but visually is really exciting for children. Now, I think this does, it hits you. It's got a story. There is a story. It might not be, you know, it might not be the most meaningful story of all, but there is a story, and there are very likeable characters, and it makes you laugh.
And the song gets stuck in your head.
Yes, forever.
You will be singing this song for days.
Because yeah, everything is awesome. I haven't seen Mr. Peabody yet, but it's half term, obviously, and so it's time for family movies, and I can't see how you wouldn't fail to get your money's worth out of this.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. The Lego film opened on Friday and is screening at both View and Cineworld Multiplex cinemas in 3D and 2D. Did you see? I saw 3D, which is awful.
2D.
Yeah, the 3D looks like it was shot in a cave. The bulbs.
That wouldn't have helped your enjoyment, Tony.
I know. I like the film. Don't get me wrong. I really like the film. Sometimes I clap my hands in happiness. It was so good. But at the end of it, similar to The Fifth Element and City of Lost Children, two films I don't like, I just came out with a huge headache. And just thought it, you know, too much noise, too much activity.
3D
I wanted
gives
it.
Me a bit of headache anyway.
Yeah, the 3D sort of point.
Go
anyway.
Watch it again, 2D at the back of the screen, and see if that changes your mind.
Okay. All right. I think my mind doesn't need changing, it just needs a bit of clarification.
Clarifies your mind.
Okay. You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to the Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, and this is Bums on Seats with me, Toby Miller, and regular reviewers Jenny Colley, Emma Marchant, Sarah McIntosh, and Owen Baker. Last week, the Cambridge Arts Picture House offered a rare chance to see the original The Manchurian Candidate, part of a short season of films brought together by the cinema in conjunction with CRASH, Centre of Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities, an interdisciplinary research centre within the University of Cambridge. The screenings, which also included the upcoming Rosemary's Baby, which is on this coming Tuesday, The 39 Steps, Ken Loach's Hidden Agenda and All the President's Men, have been chosen to complement the centre's Conspiracy and Democracy project, a five-year study funded by the Leverhulme Group and led by Sir Richard Evans. Each film, which comes with an intro and a talk from one or two related speakers, has been chosen to illustrate the project's aim, to investigate the role conspiracy theories have played in the last 300 years of modern democracy. I spoke to Dave Runciman, a professor of politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Cambridge University, about the role cinema may play in the perseverance of some conspiracies and the manner in which cinema, over time, turns them into vital movie narratives. But I began by asking why the project, which has been going for just over a year, had suddenly decided to take a trip to the cinema.
One of the great dangers of conspiracy theory is that all human beings have a tendency to see patterns in randomness. Most phenomena in the world are actually random, and these patterns are an illusion. Then art, great art, is always ambiguous, so we're looking for patterns there too. You know, it's really hard often to tell with someone who is labelled a conspiracy theorist, who thinks that there's something sinister going on, there's some secret plot, the world is out to get them or out to get some other group. It's really hard often to know whether this is crazy or whether they're onto something. And we kind of found ourselves discussing the fact that this is a theme in a lot of films, ranging from horror films to political thrillers to spy movies. And often the heroes of these films are people who kind of straddle that line in that they are both paranoid and feel persecuted, and they're onto something. And so we thought it would be good to have a series of films that looked at exactly that, you know, the way in which filmmakers and actors and screenwriters have tried to kind of finesse that line between portraying a kind of paranoid worldview and also portraying a world in which it makes sense to be paranoid. And we came up with quite a long list of films, I think 20 in total possibles. And so we put these five together because we thought these five all covered that theme. We could have done a whole season of Hitchcock films around that theme, and many Hitchcock films precisely turn on that question of when is the hero crazy and paranoid and when is he right to be paranoid.
What role has storytelling and cinema played in the spread and the longevity of conspiracy theories?
Just as it's a classic feature of sort of spy films and political thrillers, it then stretches back into the origins of spy novels, certain kinds of detective fiction back into the 19th century. And then there are also the actual, you know, works, often forged, fictitious works of political writing, of which the classic example is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the anti-Semitic tract that was taken up by the Nazis, that have fueled conspiracy theories around the world and continue to do it to this day. So there are pieces of writing and indeed works of art that fuel conspiracy theories, classic anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. But they're also the things that we're interested in, and these films are an example of that. Novels, movies, which play around with this idea of a world that is not as it seems, in which small groups of people are sort of pulling the strings behind the scenes, but also in which the hero or the innocent who stumbles upon the conspiracy is kind of flailing around in the dark a lot of the time. So the final film that we've got, which is our Hitchcock, which is Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, with each film we've got an expert either in movies or in literature to introduce it. And with that one, we've got David Trotter, who's the professor of English here in Cambridge, and he's an expert on John Buchan. And he's going to relate Hitchcock's film back to Buchan's original novel, which was from 20 years earlier. And that's the relationship of that novel to kind of early 20th century ideas of international conspiracies and plots and the sort of paranoias of the time.
Can cinema be used as a reliable barometer of what the public feared at the time? In the 1950s, there was a whole decade of flying saucer films that came from the fear of the Red Menace. Can it be a reliable barometer, or is the distortion too great? Does a decade of Reaganite politics viewed through cinema just becomes a decade of Arnold Schwarzenegger films?
In a way, the classic decade, in a way, for conspiracy films is the 1970s, and we have All the President's Men as one of them. The most famous real conspiracy that we'll stumble upon in American politics is, of course, Watergate, which fueled a whole series, but it's also the age of assassination. So from the Kennedy assassination through to Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and on into the 70s, there was that kind of wave of paranoia that ran through American politics that almost reached a crescendo around Watergate, and you see that in the films of the time. But the first film in the season that we had last week, which was The Manchurian Candidate, which is from 1962, which came out at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis and preceded the Kennedy assassination by a year, and we watched it last week, and it's a very accurate barometer of both a kind of satire of McCarthyism, and it's a satire of Cold War paranoia, and it is itself a kind of paranoid film. It is a, you know, it takes brainwashing seriously. It assumes that brainwashing is something that really might happen to, you know, American manhood, which might be stripped of its power because it's been brainwashed either by the Soviets or by women or whatever it is. So you look at it and you think, though the film is satirizing its time, it's a classic product of its time as well.
What is it, Mother?
Raymond, if we were at war, and you were suddenly to become infatuated with the daughter of a Russian agent, wouldn't you expect me to come to you and object, and beg you to stop the entire thing before it was too late? Well, we are at war. It's a cold war. But it will get worse and worse until every man, woman, and child in this country will have to stand up and be counted, say whether they are on the side of right and freedom or on the side of the Thomas Jordans of this country.
On your website, there's numerous blogs, and I went through as many as I could last night, and one of them raises the question of whether old conspiracies never die. Does cinema help perpetrate old conspiracies or familiar conspiracies by just turning them into generic narratives?
One of the conspiracies that kind of just keeps coming back is the sort of New World Order conspiracy, the idea there is some secret international government out there, or there's some secret international organization that's running things behind the scenes. And that, you know, it comes up, it's in the 39 Steps. And it, you know, it runs through, you know, the classic scene in North by Northwest where he's at the United Nations, and the United Nations suddenly becomes this kind of site of something profoundly sinister. What is this organization? That conspiracy theory never seems to have gone away. In some ways, it's one of the classic ones. And I think cinema can certainly fuel it. But I think cinema also just fuels the kind of generic type of suspicion, because the distinctive feature of conspiracy theories isn't just their paranoia, but the way in which they take seemingly innocent facts about the world, things that other people haven't noticed are sinister, and they show you that there's a sinister aspect to them.
Are cinema and conspiracy theories and various forms of narrative likely bedfellows? They both seem to offer a sort of us against them secularism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely, conspiracy theories are cozy, and one of the things that perpetuates conspiracy theories is when conspiracy theorists find each other, you find people who sort of share their worldview, they form an us-against-them view of the world. And actually, one of the things that we're studying in this project is the impact of the internet on this, because a widespread assumption is that the internet or the web has fueled the rise of conspiracy theories, because it's allowed the people who have these suspicions to find each other, and they can form these little online communities in which they reinforce each other's views. So that, yeah, I mean, it might be that there is something about cinema that gives you that sense of sort of there's a little group of people, and maybe even the business of sitting in the cinema and watching a film, which has that sort of intimate quality, that you're sharing a particular worldview that other people can't see. And very skillful directors like Hitchcock, that's their genius, right, as I see it. On the one hand, you're seeing Cary Grant or whoever it is kind of on the run, and you're seeing it from the outside, but you're also kind of being invited to collude in this feeling of paranoia, this feeling that what it's like to have this big bad world out there, and you're the only one who can see there's something wrong.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many, many thanks to Professor Dave Runciman for agreeing to be interviewed at fairly late notice, and to Sally Lewis from Crash for very kindly arranging it. If you want to see any of the film screening, and the screenings are for all members of the public, then head down to the Arts Picture House on early Tuesday evenings for about 6:30. Rosemary's Baby is on this Tuesday, 18th of February. All the President's Men is screening on the 25th of February. Ken Loach's Hidden Agenda is on 4th of March. Also, Alfred Hitchcock's Brilliant and Pretty Much Perfect, The 39 Steps, is on the 11th of March. For more information, look in the Arts Picture House brochure or pop in to have an ask. Or you can find out more about the project at www.crash.cam.ac.uk.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Once we've exhausted ourselves at the top of the hour, there'll be lots more Saturday programming to take our place. Following on at 1 p.m. will be Saturday Lunch, followed an hour later by the rather brilliant Bookmark, and then at 3 p.m. by Everything Italian in Cambridge with Radio Dante. At 4 p.m. then there's something completely different with the latest football, Olympic and cricket news from 105 Sport. We've still got another 20 minutes of this programme left. We'll wrap up with the touchy-feely technology of Her, but before that, it's time to fall, always inappropriately, in love.
Truly, Mr. Dickens, it is never so alive as when it is spoken by its author.
Thank you.
Mr. Dickens!
Hello. Thank you.
You are an admirer of my husband's work?
At the moment, I'm lost in Copperfield.
Nellie has read every chapter twice.
I am glad.
Every human creature is a profound secret to every other.
Until that secret is given to another, then perhaps two human creatures may know each other.
He cannot marry me.
No, he cannot.
There is an insanity to his behaviour.
You have been in every line I have ever read. You are part of my existence. To the last hour of my life, you remain part of my character.
Everyone has their secret, and this is ours.
For his first few steps as a director, Ralph Fiennes hasn't strayed too far from his leanings as an actor, though perhaps it's that familiarity that's allowed him to take unusual stylistic decisions. As Coriolanus moved Shakespeare's military intrigue to the Balkans, whilst new release The Invisible Woman may star Fiennes as Charles Dickens, but the film itself seems closer to Robert Altman than The Merchant in Ivory. Adapted by Abby Morgan from Claire Tomalin's 1990 novel, The Invisible Woman finds Dickens, a celebrity as much as a writer, touring the country with an adoring wife and 10 children in tow. Along the way, he meets Nellie Ternan, played by Felicity Jones. Just about to turn 18, Nellie is the youngest daughter in a fatherless family of actresses. Dickens takes an instant shine to her, finding a creative spark that is, he says, lacking in his merely functional marriage. But a nation's eyes are trained on their beloved author, and an illicit romance is the last thing his reputation needs. Sarah, I'll admit, I wasn't, when I went to see this film, I wasn't particularly interested. I wasn't really expecting a great deal, but I found it actually interestingly removed from the melodramatic period piece that I was expecting. Do you think Fiennes brings life to what is, in its tropes, a very familiar love story?
I was pleasantly surprised by, I've been trying to define what it was that I was pleasantly surprised by, but aesthetically, I think this is rather refreshing how it's been filmed. The close camera work, the scenery. So, I mean, the stuff along the beach, in the fields in France. You know, it looks like sort of paintings. It's an extremely beautifully shot film. What I found difficult was relating to the characters. You've got this premise where it's set up that you're supposed to be following Nelly from the sort of present day scenes at the beginning and throughout. But then that's soon abandoned when you get into the, you know, the flashbacks, if you like. And I don't know, I was trying to work out what it was that made me feel so removed from these characters, why I wasn't connecting in the way that perhaps I should. And I sort of came to the conclusion that it's because of that abandonment of the sort of central character, the fact that you don't really have... I think there's maybe two shots that I picked up on that sort of had a point of view shot, but you don't get that at all. And I kind of wondered, you know, that then creates this remove. But I also wondered whether that was intentional in it's being set up like a theatre piece. And if that's the case, then that makes me a little bit angry, to be honest, because I find it, but. I think that there's a lot to like about it in the way that it's shot. It's very beautiful, but it is missing something in being able to connect to the characters. And I think there's a lot of, I've discussed this with someone else actually, the fact that there's a lot of lingering over the lead actress, which because of that remove becomes almost sort of leery at points and voyeuristic. And made me, I don't know if it's because I'm female myself, but just made me feel very uncomfortable.
Especially as it's an interesting decision, which is one of the things I did like about the film. As you said, Ralph Fiennes makes interesting decisions with his directorial decisions. Mm. It's much more of a dreamlike pace than I was expecting.
Yeah.
But because when he finally does abandon his marriage to his poor wife, and
yeah.
poor from the impression we were given of her, and admittedly it's not painting Dickens in an interesting in a compelling light deliberately.
No, and I really liked that, you know, he wasn't treated like some sacred cow.
No, and yeah. but you don't see them together until the third act of the film, when they go to France to escape the prying eyes of the English,
yeah.
And that's when they have their first time together, and we only deal with that with a sort of montage edit, and I thought that was interesting, but at the same time you never really see where the connection is between the two of them,
yeah.
But in a conventional sense, I'm always wary of being too quick to criticise a film like this, and we might discuss this later with her, because the things I find are missing are the things that would annoy me if they were there.
Mm.
And in the end, I just don't think the script is strong enough for what Ralph Fiennes is trying to do. I think he bears some of the responsibility. It's a bit like Tom Ford, who directed A Single Man. And Tom Ford came from a fashion designer background and directed his first film. And I like A Single Man, but it makes lots of errors that a first-time director who previously had no interest in filmmaking makes. And they're interesting errors, and sometimes they work fantastically well, than far better than what a more trained eye might have done. And I found that the same case with this. There were moments where I thought, well, the eye lines aren't meeting up, the editing's all awkward.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it kept doing things, it kept surprising me, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kept me going and made it much more of an enjoyable watch than I was expecting.
Yeah, I say, you know, I don't want to... I didn't feel connected to the characters, but that's not to say that I didn't enjoy the film on a different level. I enjoyed the film from sort of, you know, looking at it from that removed artistic point of view. As I said, you know, it's just so... pleasing to watch to the eye,
but it's not pleasing in a chocolate box way. It reminded me a little bit of Jane Campion's Bright Star.
Oh, because I was going to say it reminded me of Piano.
It had a sort, and which is the reason I brought up Altman at the beginning. It bears no stylistic resemblance to Altman, and I'm sure Fiennes wasn't aiming for that. But there was a scene when they come back from their theatre tour where they're examining their sewing bag. They're going through their clothes. Oh, this needs fixing, and it felt real and genuine, and it felt like he was trying to capture those moments that the period films don't deal with, and make these people real and rounded.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that.
No, I really liked that a lot.
There are many strengths here. I'd like Ralph Fiennes to keep, and I know we'll get it later in Hotel Budapest later this year, but it was so nice to see him throwing off this somber atmosphere he seems to carry in every role and just be this bouncing ball of light that he is when Dickens is on tour, that wrapping everybody up with him. And who was it? I can't remember his name now. The chap who played Wilkie Collins was also very
Tom Hollander.
Yeah, that's Wilkie Collins.
He's always amazing.
It made interesting ideas about his marriage, about that he wasn't married, that he was just had a, but everybody knew he had a mistress or a live-in lover, and that made interesting points, but it never quite went down those roads fully enough. But no, I think it's far better than I expected it to be, and I was prepared to sort of dislike it because some actors find it not easy to get funding, but do we really need another Charles Dickens story?
Yeah.
But I think it's worthwhile going to see.
No, definitely. I mean, you know, there is that issue with the connectability of the characters, but at the end of the day, it's an exciting film to see from an artistic point of view, and I'm very excited to see what he's going to be doing next.
Okay. Well, The Invisible Woman opened last week and is still screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A. Considering his pivotal role in creating both anarchic pop videos and the baldy tomfoolery of Jackass and Bad Grandpa, it's always surprising to find as a feature film director, Spike Jonze has a melancholic leaning. His adaptation of Where the Wild Things Are puts Sendak's monsters on the psychiatrist's couch, whilst his new film, Her, builds a possible future simply as a home for a lovelorn hero. A mustachioed Joaquin Phoenix plays Theodore, a mild-mannered writer who's having trouble accepting his marriage to his childhood sweetheart is drawing to an end. Partly as a distraction, he buys the latest in artificial intelligence operating systems, a program named Samantha, given voice by Scarlett Johansson. Her gentle prying into his love life amuses Theodore, but as he tries to regain his romantic feet, he finds himself falling for the seductive and smart and caring voice of his computer.
Good morning, Theodore.
Good morning.
You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed?
Telling the truth is not polite.
The woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, she's an operating system.
You're dating in a West? What is that like?
I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
I want to learn everything about everything. I want to discover myself.
I want that for you, too.
Keep going. Keep going. Falling in love is kind of like a form of socially acceptable insanity. We're only here briefly. And while I'm here, I want to allow myself joy.
I've never loved anyone the way I love you.
Me too. Now I know how.
Jenny, I found Her to be an ostentatious film, but it seemed to bewilder some of the audiences in my screening last night who might have been expecting a more traditional, not rom-com, but a more traditional romance. Or indeed might have been surprised by the way the romance was fairly traditional. Anyway, I'll give you a question. what did you think of Spike Jonze's first film, both as writer and director?
I'm still thinking about it, I have to say. It's the kind of movie, I came out of it and I thought, for one, it was really beautiful. It was visually tremendous. I thought the way he kind of built this near future world, and I could really see how our world could transition to it. I thought the world that he'd built was lovely. I thought the performances were just very natural. You could get behind all of the characters. You could kind of understand their motivations. I thought the story was lovely, but there was so much to think about afterwards. I feel like I'm probably not going to make up my mind on whether I really liked this film for some weeks. My initial gut reaction was I liked it a lot, but it's the kind of movie, there's so much that it just has to think about afterwards. I mean, the nature of the relationship between Samantha and Theodore is is fascinating. And my, I went to see it with my flatmate, and she just kept saying to me afterwards, but do you think that could happen? I was like, I'm still thinking, stop asking me questions. And it is the kind of movie you want to go see with somebody else, because there is so much to talk about when you come out of it. I don't think it was necessarily bewildering. I don't think there was much to bewilder in the film. But I did think it was really interesting.
Owen, Jenny's echoed my own thoughts there, and that I came out and I liked it, and Emma, who was sitting behind me, vouched for this. I liked it, but I wasn't I wasn't fully proclaiming my love for it. It took the drive home for me to realise that, no, I think I really liked that. And again, for the reasons I mentioned with The Invisible Woman, I liked the things it didn't do. And even sometimes it actually, occasionally, it bored me. But I'm now beginning to think that might have been slightly deliberate, which might be a lousy excuse.
Yeah, I can feel, because I can sense, and having spoken to some of the people here beforehand, I can sense there's quite a lot of love/liking of this film. I'm finding myself liking it less. That might be a bit stupid, but there is an awful lot to like about the film, an awful lot. It is beautifully rendered. I mean, and to be fair, there's some genuinely funny moments in it. I mean, you said rom-com/romance. I think there is a bit of a almost a hard thing to define that, because I think there is a genuinely comedic edge to this film, some of which is a bit stupid, but I really liked it. I really loved the way that it rendered this near future world without being, it had a sort of 70s feel to it, and yet it was obviously futuristic, and it didn't ram it down your throat, but it worked quite well. And I also think you have to mention how beautifully naturalistic the relationship between two people, one of whom you never see, is. I mean, it never feels false. It never feels forced. You never think, oh, she wasn't there. I mean, the Scarlett Johansson, Joaquin Phoenix relationship is extraordinary and utterly convincing, considering she's a computer. But I have a couple of really significant reservations. One is, I think the middle section of this film flags a lot. I was bored. But the beginning and the end are very strong, so it didn't bother me too much. But the bigger problem I have with it is there is a scene very near the beginning where she's talking about books, and he says, you've read that book already, and she says, it took me a thousandth of a second or something. And the idea behind this film is really interesting. It's fascinatingly done, but I have real problems with the kind of the technology almost. She can read a book in a thousandth of a second, which suggests to me, and she's obviously working when she's offline, if you like, suggests to me she would have read all the books in the history of mankind after about 3 days. And yet, when he takes her to the beach at one point in this film, she's surprised they're at the beach, in spite of the fact that he's shown her the whole journey. She would know. And that in itself isn't a problem. But for me, the problem is that, you know, she's obviously developing and growing emotionally. I have no problem with that. As her almost childlike at the beginning, and then by the end, much more sort of intelligent and
godlike.
Godlike, absolutely. But I have a real problem with doing the same thing with her intelligence, because her intelligence would be formed from the beginning. Her emotion, I totally believe.
Well, I'm not sure, because she's an AI, so she's like a computer game character that gets smarter the more you play it.
But I think she would get smarter much, much quicker, because she's doesn't require to be played. She is working in the background all the time, and she says that.
Emma's pulling a face, which doesn't work on radio. Can you add
my
vocals?
Issue with it, because I tell you, Owen, I am not one of the... I did not love it. I didn't.
No.
I found myself very unconnected from it. I thought it was a bit bland. I thought it was a bit dreary. And my issue is, actually, I find their relationship unutterably dull. I just found he and Samantha's relationship. So you're saying you can't work out where he comes from. You never see them having a conversation that's anything other
I think that's deliberate.
It might be the point. I think I said something about maybe this is the point that, you know, the scenes they have where they shoot everybody who obviously is walking around chatting to their OSs. And I love the fact that about halfway through, we haven't mentioned Amy Adams, but Amy Adams is like his one kind of real friend, you know, real life friend. And she is just luminous, as she always is. But they have this great conversation where they're chatting about all these people they know who are kind of having a relationship with their OSs, because she's having a relationship, not a romantic one, but she's having a very close relationship with her own OS. So I like the fact that they recognise that this isn't just Theodore being odd, that they are, you know, that this is a new step in forward in relationships for all these characters living in this new future or whatever. And, you know, you see these scenes where no one is interacting with each other. They're all just chatting to their own individual operating systems. And that is obviously an interesting comment on where perhaps we are all going with our own.
Well, none of them, even when we have, with the exception of Amy Adams and Joaquin Phoenix's relationship, and it's pointed out they've known each other for many, many, many years, none of the human beings have real... Nobody's
you have
angry
the Chris Pratt relationship. You have when he goes out on that double date to the beach with Chris Pratt in his second great role this week, obviously, after the Lego movie, and he has a real-life girlfriend. But they completely take it in their stride that they're going out for a date with Theodore and his girlfriend, Samantha, who happens to be an operating system. I like the fact that, that's recognised. But like I say, I just found their relationship...
I know, and I think it was dull as well, but thinking about it afterwards, that's what gave it in my head, and maybe it's not what Spike Jonze meant, but I think Joaquin Phoenix's character, the character he most resembles in recent films is Michael Fassbender in Shame. If you think of relationships, put relationships in the place of sex addiction, he's having the same sort of relationship that he's constantly having in that film. And then you realise, well, everybody's having that same sort of relationship. And then it becomes rather a nihilistic, disturbing film.
I thought a bit about Ruby Sparks as well, actually, while I was watching it. A film which I like. I actually liked Ruby Sparks more than this. And I thought about The Man with Two Brains.
I thought about The Man with Two Brains, yes.
But it's not as funny as The Man with Two Brains, but more beautiful.
just a very quick point on the relationship. I completely agree with you. I think the relationship is kind of... dull to an extent and sort of and facile. I think
it's self-serving.
Yeah, absolutely self-serving. But what I meant by it being completely convincing is I think it's completely convincing. I just think it's a very dull relationship. I don't think it's a good relationship, but I think it's the relationship almost between the actors, if you like, more than the couple is you never question it. You don't. I didn't find myself going, oh, this is utterly unrealistic, in spite of the fact that it's a computer.
It was, but I didn't have a problem with the fact that Spike Jonze maybe fudges the technology a bit, because, you know, at the end as well, the reason that they have to obviously leave somehow, and it doesn't really make any technological sense why they all have to leave or whatever, but yeah. I didn't, that to me didn't worry me.
No, that was God abandoning the people. Was everybody believes that's we've got to wrap this up, sadly, but the scene on the subway steps is where the film's laid bare. All the homilies, all the Hallmark card homilies in the first half of the film, which are delivered seriously on the subway steps scene, Spike Jonze shows they are ridiculous. Everything everybody says in this film is ridiculous. And when she leaves at the end, that's everybody thinks with their relationship with a god, whichever god it is, she only loves me. And you find out, oh, how many other people do you love? Well, 642. That's brilliant. I thought that was brilliant. Anyway, you've got to wrap up. Well, I don't usually like having the last word, but we're very near the end. Sorry. No, I didn't mean to be rude. Anyway, Her opened yesterday, February the 14th, and is showing at the Cambridge Arts Picture House. It is Certificate 15. That is all we have time for on the show today. The last hour will become a podcast, a little bit tidied up, maybe some of the audio feedback removed. And we're on iTunes, don't forget. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. We'll be back on the 1st of March, where Mark Liversidge will be in the hosting chair. We'll have Only Lovers Left Alive, Stranger on the Lake, and the two parts of Nymphomaniac. Will play out with some of Jim Jarmusch's self-penned score for the aforementioned Only Lovers Left Alive, which opens next week at the Arts Picture House. Very excited about that. Please stay tuned for the Saturday lunch, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.